This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
Hellbound atheist, infidel, or unbeliever, I have to say it's a hell of a pleasure to broadcast this show every week. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
It is a lot of fun. I'm Dan Barker, your co-host, and your friendly neighborhood atheist.
This broadcast is originating, as always, from the Madison, Wisconsin. Today is March 19th, 2011. Free Thought Radio is also airing in Atlanta, Grand Rapids, Michigan, and in Monterey. And if it's not on your favorite local radio station, please pitch it.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the National Freedom From Religion Foundation. We are an effective state church watchdog and advocacy group, the nation's largest association of freethinkers who are non-believers, atheists, and agnostics. We have more than 16,200 members now. We're growing fast. Why don't you become a dues-paying atheist or agnostic? And join us at ffrf.org.
On the second half of today's show, we'll speak with Sikivu Hutchinson. She is a writer, an African-American, a university educator, and author of a new book called Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values Wars. She asks, why are 87% of Black women regular churchgoers? Why is the Bible the most read book in Black America? And why are African Americans still the poorest and most religious group in the nation?
And in a moment, we'll talk with attorney and FFRF member Richard W. Morris of Surprise, Arizona, about the surprising new lawsuit that he and Mark Victor have just filed on behalf of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, seeking to enjoin Governor Jan Brewer from issuing her Arizona Day of Prayer proclamation this year in conjunction with the National Day of Prayer.
But before that, we have to comment on the inevitable blaming the victims by religionists when there is an earthquake. We have the usual suspects. This is Hold Your Nose, Glenn Beck, the Mormon blowhard from Fox TV.
Now look, I'm not saying God is, causing earthquakes. Well, no, I'm not saying that I'm not saying that either.
Yes, that laugh really got me.
He goes on to say that all these earthquakes always have a message in them. God is trying to teach us something. We also saw the Reverend Cho Young-gi from South Korea. He's with the Full Gospel Church. Last week he said, it also comes to my mind that the earthquake could be a warning from God to Japan, which has become an increasingly material-centric, secular, and idol-worshipping country. From a religious point of view, the Japanese people have lost a great deal of faith in God over the years.
We also had a less usual suspect, a Shintoist, and I guess religionists are the same the world over. Shintaro Ishihara, who's the Tokyo governor, described the tsunami as Timbatsu, divine punishment.
Well, it's not just God's wrath.
It's not God's wrath, Dan.
Well, either way, it's not God's wrath. It's not the fault of the poor victims in Japan or in Haiti or wherever a devastating earthquake or tsunami occurs. The fault is of plate tectonics.
And there's a pun. Not a very funny pun. We'll talk a bit more about Japan in the second segment, but now we have on the phone with us from the Phoenix area, attorney Richard W. Morris, who with attorney Mark J. Victor just filed a federal lawsuit with the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Welcome to Free Thought Radio, and thank you, Richard.
It is my pleasure.
So why don't you tell everybody who's listening, who are we suing and why are we suing?
Well, in a nutshell, the FFRF is suing the governor of Arizona to enjoin her from proclaiming a state day of prayer. Now, previously, she's been in office 2 years and then was just elected. The previous 2 years, she did declare a day of prayer that coincided with the National Day of Prayer. But in addition, and this is the only one that I know of, in January of 2010, she declared a state day of prayer for the budget.
Oh, boy.
And did it work?
Well, no, nothing fails like prayer, and the budget didn't either.
Now, you have found four Arizona members of the Freedom From Religion Foundation to serve as those all-important local plaintiffs. And one of them, John Compeer, is a former minister like you, Dan.
So yeah, that's right. I met John in Scottsdale a couple months ago.
But you and Mark approached us about this. I mean, you said there is this Arizona Day of Prayer that the governor does, and you knew that we had filed in Colorado. Can you tell us what we're asking the federal court to do? Which judge do we have and all that jazz?
Well, the judge we have is the presiding judge of the Arizona District Court. It's Judge Silver. And judges are assigned these, by the way, randomly. So let me give you a little bit of that process very quickly. We file all federal lawsuits such as this electronically. You don't go down to the courthouse and pay a fee and file a bunch of paper. It's all done in PDF, and it's all done on the Internet. And the computer that accepts that also randomly assigns judges. And the judge that was randomly assigned to this is Judge Silver. So we will be dealing with her. Unless we elect also, if we want to, we can elect to use a magistrate judge. Now, it takes both parties to agree to that. I think, given the significance of the case, though, that we don't want to use a magistrate judge.
And the National Day of Prayer, for listeners who don't know this, and probably most of them do, is by order of Congress the first Thursday in May. And what you are asking the federal court to do is to enjoin Governor Brewer from being able to issue her Arizona Day of Prayer this year in conjunction with that National Day of Prayer. Is that right?
That's correct. Now, this lawsuit is somewhat different from the case in Wisconsin, for example, that's on appeal. There, you were dealing specifically with the U.S. federal Constitution on the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law. Then Congress passed the law, so
yes,
that should be pretty clear that that's a violation. We don't have that in the state. The second difference that we also have between the Wisconsin and the Arizona case is that in Wisconsin, it was done after the fact. In other words, the governor had and the president had already declared that such and such is a day of prayer and then was suing to say, oh, no, this was always wrong. Instead of that, what we have done in Arizona is become more active and saying we would like to have an injunction before you do it to say you're not allowed to do it. So what? Ours is more before the event rather than after.
Aren't you also asking for a declaration of that it's unconstitutional? In addition,
yes, and that's the reason for the injunction.
Yeah.
Now, in the lawsuit, the legal complaint that you and Mark Victor wrote on behalf of FFRF and the plaintiffs states that this, of course, is an unconstitutional preference for religion. But why don't you talk a little bit more about there's a lot of emphasis on how having a governor exhort you to pray if you are a state constituent is really turning us into political outsiders.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, not political outsiders, but if you look at many things that go on that are privately done, I'm going to come back to your question here. I don't want you to think I'm one of those typical lawyers or politician who just walks around it. But if you look at even some of the private organizations that are civic organizations, many people belong to them, and they do very nice things, the Kiwanis Club, Rotarians, etc. Many atheists cannot or will not, I shouldn't say cannot, they choose not to join those because they all start with a Pledge of Allegiance and with some sort of prayer invocation. And in the case of Rotarians, for example, they just seem to have that as part of their motif, which keeps a lot of people from participating in what would otherwise be something good. On the government level, it's somewhat the same thing. If the government is saying to everybody, and everybody I'm talking about now being in the state of Arizona, that we are declaring that this is going to be a state day of prayer. Well, now, how does a person who doesn't believe take part in anything like that, or do they have to remain as the outsider?
But you can't not be a citizen. You are a citizen, so it's
yes, that's right.
You can refuse to join Kiwanis, but how can you not be a citizen?
Exactly what the point is, and that's why you can choose not to be Kiwanian or whatever they call themselves, but you cannot choose to be non-Arizonan if you happen to live here.
Now, Richard, you were very interested in using also the complaint to educate, and why don't you talk a little bit about some of the historic references that the complaint makes?
Yes. Whenever I listen to a group of people who get onto the subject of separation of church and state, one of the most common items that seems to come up is, quote, this is a Christian nation, end quote, or this was founded believing in Jesus Christ, or and we're Jehovah, which is the Abrahamic God. And one of the things I wanted to show in the complaint itself is, as far back as 1791, this was not true. And 1791 is a long time ago. This was at the time of the founding. So I think it's significant to point out that at the time of the founding, we were not a Christian nation. No matter what you might want to say or change the history, we were not a Christian nation. And the Constitution itself is very careful to have only one oath in it, which is the oath for president. And in it, it does not mention God. So the founding was not from the Christian religion, as is so often said. So what I wanted to do in the complaint, very often people will read the complaint, but they would never read any other documents that might be filed. Let's say, in this case, I anticipate motions coming. And in the motions, we would be bringing up the things that all what's in the complaint. But in the complaint, and I wanted to give some history of it, number one, for anyone who would read nothing further. And secondly, I wanted to get the state to admit that we signed the Treaty of Tripoli. And at that point, I think we've established that it's a sectarian country.
We only have about a minute left. So you're talking about the Treaty of Tripoli that was ratified under Washington, signed by John Adams.
Correct.
It said the United States is in no way founded as a Christian religion. And then you also cite, and people can go to our website to read the complaint and the press release, but you also cite, of course, the beautiful words of Thomas Jefferson in his letter where he talks about the wall of separation between church and state. Well, it's very exciting that we are suing Governor Brewer. I'm all for it, and I'm hoping that we can get somewhere with that injunction, that they will give you a chance to make this case in court, Richard Morris, and thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Talk with you later.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. We'll be right back to talk a bit about what you can give up for Lent and to imagine spring and to talk with an African-American atheist woman, activist, and author.
Hello, my name is Ian Bell, originally from England, but now residing on the north side of Chicago. I'm proud to be on Free Thought Radio.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. March 20th is the vernal equinox, and you know what that means.
Yes, Lent. And here's what Stephen Colbert is giving up for Lent.
As TV's most famous Catholic, I am observing Ash Wednesday, the beginning of Lent. And the ash on my forehead is a Christian symbol of sacrifice, penance, and mortality. It's basically the hand stamp for God's nightclub. Now, you needed to get back in. Now, during the Lenten season, it's traditional for every Catholic to give up something that is important to him or himself. And It's got to be something that means something big to them, okay? Something that really matters, something it would be painful for them to do without. So for the next 40 days, I am giving up Catholicism. It's a difficult sacrifice, but that just shows my devotion to the great religion that I no longer practice. Okay, I'm going to get that off there. That's pretty good. Did I get it? That's pretty much, yeah, look good? All right. All right. Wow. I feel so empty. Is this what Unitarians feel like all the time? I mean, this is terrible. Now there's nothing to keep me from masturbating. Fight it, fight it, fight it.
Well, Stephen, why don't you give up Catholicism for 40 years?
Spring is finally showing up in Madison, Wisconsin. Too late to warm the 100,000 frozen human icicles that were at the Wisconsin State Capitol protesting along with me a week ago. We want to play a song called One Sweet Morning with a promise of spring, peace, justice. Lyrics by Atheist Harburg, music by Earl Robinson, recorded by Dan, played in solidarity with our friends in Wisconsin and the people
of
Japan.
Out of the fallen leaves, the autumn world over. Out of the shattered rose that will smile no more. Out of the embers of blossoms and ashes of clover. Spring will bloom one sweet morning. One sweet morning, the rose will rise to wake the heart and make it wise. Out of the fallen lads, the summer world over. Out of their flags plowed under a distant shore. Out of the dreams in their bones buried under the clover. Peace will come one sweet morning. One sweet morning, the rose will rise to wake the heart and make it wise. This is the cry of life, the winter world over. Sing me no sad amen, but a bright encore. For out of the flags and the bones buried under the clover, spring will bloom, peace will come, one sweet morning.
That's One Sweet Morning.
One Sweet Morning.
One Sweet Morning, lyrics by Yip Harburg. I'm Annie Larigella with Dan Barker. Coming up, an African-American atheist, feminist activist, and author, Sikivu Hutchinson.
Hi, my name is James Hubble. I'm from Springfield, Missouri, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie, and here's Dan.
And our guest on the telephone today from South Los Angeles is Sikivu Hutchinson. And I think I'm saying her first name right. She'll tell me if I need to correct that. Sikivu Hutchinson is a writer, a specialist for the Los Angeles County Human Relations Commission. She earned her PhD in performance studies from New University, and she's taught women's studies, cultural studies, urban studies, and education at UCLA, at the California Institute of the Arts, and Western Washington University. She's the author of Imagining Transit, Race, Gender, and Transportation Politics in Los Angeles. She's published fiction, essays, and critical theory in many periodicals. She's the editor of blackfemlens.org, a senior fellow for the Institute for Humanist Studies. And her new book, which just came out, which we're going to talk about today, is called Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values Wars. So welcome to Free Thought Radio, Sikivu.
Thank you. Glad to be here. And just one little correction. I'm an alum of NYU, New York University.
Oh, New York University.
Okay. Shout out to NYU.
Oh, our copy cut off. Sorry.
No problem.
So I got your book. I think I was one of the first to buy it. I saw you in Thousand Oaks. When was that?
Right.
About a few weeks ago. And it was hot off the press, and I am really impressed, I have to tell you. I was expecting to be impressed, thinking, you know, it's a nice humanist book about values and atheism and that. But, boy, the breadth of it and the depth of it and your analysis of history and of race relations and black identity and all that. Tell us briefly, why did you write this book?
Well, I was compelled to write it because I am an African-American feminist atheist and a humanist, and I did not see that particular perspective being represented within mainstream, quote-unquote, new atheist discourse, nor did I see it being represented within African-American feminist discourse. So I felt that there was a need to try and really bring together a range of issues, not just pertaining to religiosity within the African-American community, not just pertaining to the ongoing debate around the role of science in the United States and the religious rights, you know, hijacking of the centrality of science and scientific discourse and inquiry, but really to look at the dynamics of gender justice, LGBT equality, and the socioeconomic lens that a lot of African Americans bring to their investment in organized religion. And I was not seeing that kind of perspective represented within the literature.
Well, I noticed that you point out in your book that from the perspective of many African Americans, atheism and feminism, to a lot of them, are kind of viewed as white movements, and there's even some suspicion among black women, for example, about feminism because it's perceived as not really relating to what they are struggling with. Isn't that true?
Yeah, that's very much true. And actually, I just spoke about this at a black women's health conference about a week ago, and that conference was focused on looking at how we might bring a gender lens, a gender justice lens, to social justice, because historically, gender within the African-American community, within mainstream African-American social thought and discourse, has really been viewed as a white woman's terrain. There's been a lot of hostility, you know, between African-American womanists slash feminists and white feminists historically, going back to the 19th century with the suffrage movement. You know, there's been a lot of, obviously, racist and white supremacist, you know, ideology within early white feminist movement writing and discourse. And I think that there's just been a lot of misunderstanding about black women's role within the American women's movement. The fact that African-American women since slavery have been really critical to moving gender justice, social justice, and racial justice to the forefront of liberation struggles around gender equality, you know, in terms of work, around domestic issues, around sexual violence in the household and in the workplace. So there are a whole range, I think, of tensions that exist, you know, between white feminists and African American feminists on a very particularized level, but on a broader level, there's just a lot of hostility within African-American mainstream circles towards anything that smacks of gender justice or feminism.
Well, and bringing it back to atheism, free thought, on a personal level, you talk about the hostility, that there's a lot of hostility in the African-American community toward the idea of atheism. What have you experienced?
I've experienced it on a personal level in terms of being an out female atheist and the kind of stigma that that brings. I've had some encounters with people in the community that obviously look askance when I make it known that I am an atheist, that I eschew religion, that I don't go to church. I don't observe any of the hierarchical, dogmatic, you know, dictates of the black church. I've been an open critic of those dogmas and those hierarchies in my writing. I've had some blowback in terms of local African-American publications that did not want to publish pieces by me because I was an avowed atheist, and they felt that that would be a skewed, prejudicial perspective, you know, vis-a-vis looking at issues of, you know, religion and race in the United States. I've had things come up where I was disinvited, you know, from speaking to community groups, youth groups, because of my atheism. So there's been blowback. I would just nuance it to say that it hasn't impacted me in a deep way professionally yet. I think I've been allowed a lot of freedom because I'm here on the West Coast. You know, there's at least that veneer and patina, you know, of acceptance, you know, of different views, of secularist views. But I think that, you know, beneath the surface, that there has definitely been, you know, some blowback.
But my impression is not just, I mean, because I think all atheists and agnostics and skeptics get a lot of cold shouldering or stigmatizing in society in general. But it's my impression that in the black community, an avowal of atheism is almost seen as a betrayal of race. You know, that the black church stands for so much, and somehow if you're not part of that, you know, then you're betraying other black people. Am I right in sensing that there's a lot of guilt tripping about that, and that this misunderstanding that somehow you're turning your back on your fellow and sisters?
Yes, because African-American women comprise the majority of churchgoers in the traditional black church. So about, I'd say 87%, you know, of African-American women are dedicated churchgoers, you know, to the traditional black church denominations. So that's a huge departure for someone to openly and explicitly stake atheism, you know, as their identity, as their public identity. And in addition to the gender dynamic, as you alluded to, the black church has played a critical role in the foundations of African-American communities since basically we were brought here. So in staking that claim as an atheist, it has a lot of implications in terms of one's personal relationships, in terms of one's connection to the community, and also in terms of one's professional profile. You know, being known as an African-American female atheist is not going to be, you know, the best means of promoting oneself within black community, you know, because of the depth and intractability of those ties to the black church.
So with knowing all that, why have you done it? And what would you say to the African-American community, to your friends, to colleagues, to people you meet about why you are an atheist and why you think they shouldn't go to church?
Well, I think an important dimension to this is not just atheism, it's humanism. So throughout the book, I try to make a really critical connection between a humanist worldview that involves a deep commitment and investment to social justice. And this is not something that is alien within African-American history and social thought. A number of the major thinkers, activists, and intellectuals in African-American history and social thought have identified as secular humanists. They have not been explicitly atheist in their public identification, but they have been explicitly secularist and really attempting to deconstruct what many believe to be the colonialist legacy of African-American adherence to Christian traditions and Christian ideology. So that's been a huge element of my analysis. Let's look at the colonialist and imperialist element of African-American adoption of Christianity. Let's look at the degree to which blacks were in many ways compelled, in many ways forced to adopt Christianity because they were attempting to survive deep Holocaust conditions in which their identities, their sense of subjectivity, their sense of humanity was basically deracinated. They didn't have any traditions coming over here that were sustainable traditions in terms of language and religion and a coherent culture, you know, as African peoples. So that's been, again, a big aspect of what I would like to call developing critical consciousness about our legacy as secular humanist, you know, if not atheist, critics of the very regimes and power hierarchies of American authority in quote-unquote democracy, in addition to really attempting to make some type of critical real-life here-and-now connections between gender justice, women's conditions in African-American communities, the fact that we have skyrocketing HIV/AIDS contraction rates, we have high rates of intimate partner violence, high rates of sexual assault, and all of those have to do in some way, shape, or form with these hierarchies of gender that are imposed by the regime of Christian belief and Christian dogma. So in the book, I make a very tangible connection between these traditions, these regimes of really dehumanizing and objectifying black femininity, you know, connecting them to African-American misogyny and sexism, but also to the overarching structures of patriarchy and dehumanization of women that are absolutely institutionalized in American mainstream society.
We are talking with Sikivu Hutchinson, who is author of the new book, Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values War. And we'll be back to talk some more with her about why the church was seen as a safe place, how we can make the secular humanist atheist movement a safe place for African Americans as well. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker, and we'll be right back.
I'm State Senator Ernie Chambers from Nebraska. I'm on Free Thought Radio, which is like an oasis in the Sahara Desert.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We're speaking on the phone from South Los Angeles with the author Sikivu Hutchinson, whose new book is Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values Wars.
Now, we were just talking in the last segment with you, Sikivu, partly about how you see slavery as something that was part of the Christian effort, but this isn't something that modern African Americans tend to see. And so it's a big break for black atheists in the community. You can be a persona non grata, I take it.
Right.
There's also the our concern in the atheist agnostic community, freethinkers, to get more representation, to be more open, more diverse. So how can we reach out to African Americans who are non-believers?
Well, there are a number of ways that can be done. I, for one, have been part of a local black skeptics group here in L.A., comprised of several non-believers all over the map in terms of what they publicly identify as or don't publicly identify as. But I think that it really comes from collaboration with like-minded groups. Now, there aren't a lot of black secularist groups out there, but there are other African-American, you know, social justice groups that have similar issues and interests to the secular community, one being, you know, LGBT marriage equality, you know, one being, you know, gender justice, you know, for women of color. There's scores of other issues that secularist groups, if they really make the effort, can outreach and collaborate with these groups on. So that's one issue. Another issue is trying to diversify and broaden the platform for leaders in national organizations of a secularist bent. In the book, I mention how most of these organizations do not have African-American or other people of color in visible leadership roles. That needs to change. That's a second issue. Third issue is conferences, confabs, meetings that have national heft and national visibility absolutely need to have people of color presenting, caucusing, being visible, collaborating on whatever secular initiatives are going down, you know, be they local, be they national. I think those are three very key things. So, you know, just to recap, diversify your issues. You know, don't constantly fixate on, and this is a huge thing that I bring up ad nauseum in the book, constant fixation on science, intelligent design, what have you. All very worthwhile issues, but that's not going to achieve and promote diversity within the secularist movement. There needs to be broader scope.
Because people who feel minority and marginalized are primarily concerned more with the social issues and equality issues, and they won't even get to the other things until there's some more equity in the world, is what you're saying.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically what we as people of color have to struggle with on a day-to-day concretized basis. Institutional racism, institutional sexism, institutional heterosexism, economic injustice. And that's a main theme in the book.
Now you,
yes.
I'm sorry. You in your book, you also have make some interesting accusations, really, that urban storefront churches are part of the economic problem.
Yeah. So urban storefront churches are really symptomatic of what I would characterize as the underdevelopment of so-called inner city communities. I have a problem with that term. That's why I say so-called. Inner city, the whole term is you know, basically perceived as being this space of cultural and economic pathology. And in the book, I outline how the storefront church is just symptomatic of the fact that there has not been any meaningful attempt by local governments, local municipalities, to pour in retail and commercial dollars, dollars that would go towards green space, that would go to recreational space, cultural space, that kind of capital, social capital, is really lacking in urban communities of color, high poverty communities. And so you have storefront churches that are able to enter the breach because of tax exemptions, because they're able to make leases that small business owners, you know, would not be able to make because they're not being provided, you know, with government funding for small business loans. You have a whole array, a constellation of issues that really speaks to the depth of de facto segregation and institutional racism and capitalist exploitation in urban communities of color.
And in many cases, you say these churches are really just parasitical is what they're doing. They're taking advantage of the situation.
Right, right. You know, they serve a very limited clientele. They don't add anything, you know, to the local community in terms of engaging in social justice issues for the most part. They're not doing anything in terms of improving blight in the community. In fact, in many instances, they add blight.
Well, the tax base, for one thing.
Right, exactly.
And we're seeing the big exposés in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in the last couple of weeks about all these vacant storefront churches that are off the tax rolls that are not being used. I mean, they're in, you know, not just talking about black churches, but it's a big tax burden for all the other people in the city.
Right.
So,
right. And in the book, I make this point that the issue is disproportionately impacting African-American Latino communities, again, because of these forces of residential segregation, the fact that there are no jobs, you know, for the most part, in high-poverty inner-city communities. So you have a high population that's transit-dependent. You have a high population that is not able to, again, you know, find basic social services, social welfare resources anywhere in many instances, except for the local church.
Yeah, and that's where we really need to work hard, because that's, I think, what in Europe where they do not, where they have a social network, they don't have religion.
Absolutely.
We're
Absolutely.
Talking with Sikivu Hutchinson. Her new book is called Moral Combat, Black Atheists, Gender Politics, and the Values Wars. Well, thank you so much, Sikivu. Did I say your name right?
Yes, you did. Thanks so much.
We're going out with a little bit of Scott Joplin's Trimonisha in the background. And we also want to thank our engineer and producer, Brian Tarani, for faithlessly producing our show. And our announcer is Buzz Kemper. This show is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. And you can go to ffrf.org/radio to hear archives and to sign up for the podcast.
And thanks also for Richard Morris for joining us. Ask for more information for the March issue, which is very interesting, of Free Thought Today, at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. And we urge you to join us. Don't just ask for information, but help us and become part of the Free Thought movement. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope so.